Addiction impacts all of us. Historically, resources for families of addicts and alcoholics have been few and far between. You're listening to the Voices in Courage podcast with K.L. Wells, where we help these supportive families understand the mind of an addict and transform amidst a loved one's addiction. We share hopeful stories, real conversations, and powerful tools, offering support and solutions to escape the chaos of addiction and shift into a life of thriving. We explore the challenges of isolation, shame, and shattered dreams, and share how to take back control of your life. Subscribe at voicesincourage.com and get access to our exclusive newsletter, blogs, and other transformational resources, and discover a growing community to help you thrive. Thanks for tuning in.
So welcome to another episode of Voices in Courage with K.L. Wells. And today we are incredibly blessed to have somebody on that I have heard lots about through the last few months. And she is extraordinary in the space of grief and anxiety, has her own story and has written prolifically about this, is an expert in this arena and speaks all the time on the big stations and writes on the big papers. And so we're going to dive into this today. And if you would, Claire Bidwell Smith, please start with kind of your story of origin. Where did all this begin for you?
Yeah. Well, thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here today and talk with you.
Great.
I'm an only child and my parents were a little bit older. When I was 14, they both got cancer at the same time. My father found out first that he had prostate cancer. And within a few months, my mother was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer. So my high school and adolescence years were really fraught with a lot of ups and downs and uncertainty and kind of facing mortality in a way that a lot of my peers weren't. My mother died when I was a freshman in college, and it was incredibly difficult. She was an amazing woman, and we were very, very close, and she had been a wonderful mom. And she had really struggled to face her own illness and pending death, and so we never really talked about it. So when she died, there was a lot that was just unspoken, unsaid. I had a lot of regrets, a lot of missed opportunities. My father died a few years later, just as I graduated college, in my mid-20s, alone in the world with no immediate family. And it was really challenging. I descended into a lot of deep grief. Anxiety was a huge aspect of my struggle. And I eventually began to find lots of different ways to heal and work through it. It took a lot of work, took a lot of time. When I came through it, I decided to go back and get my master's degree in clinical psychology and became a therapist. And I worked in hospice initially as a bereavement counselor. I've now been in private practice for 15 years. I've written 5 books about grief and loss. I work with people one-on-one every day. I lead support groups. I train other mental health professionals in the field of grief. And I speak a lot about grief and anxiety.
What was the intention behind your taking your journey and actually creating a calling for yourself?
I struggled so much in my own journey. When my mom died, I was 18 years old and everybody around me just told me I would be fine. I was an adult now and to kind of get on with things. And I wasn't fine.
Right.
I was, again, really struggling with crippling anxiety and just carrying the weight of so much grief and didn't know where to turn. This was 25 years ago, and there were more than that. I'm 45 now. That was 27 years ago, and there weren't the kind of books out there are now and social media and podcasts
right.
about grief. And I just felt so alone. And because I had to work so hard to figure out how to cope with my own anxiety and how to really be in my grief and heal from it, mm-hmm. I really just wanted to help others do the same. I'd always been a writer. And since I was a kid, I did not grow up wanting to be a grief therapist.
But you journaled.
So, yeah. And yeah. So I've always written a lot about it. And when mm-hmm. I began working in hospice, I was really like, I went into that work thinking I knew a lot about grief, but I only knew my own grief. I knew my
right.
personal grief. And what I
right.
began to see was grief in a much more 3-dimensional way. And mm-hmm. seeing all these kind of universal traits of grief, really common struggles to understand and work with grief. And then a lot of different ways to grieve that I had never imagined or thought about. And I just really wanted to kind of open up that conversation more for our culture.
And so when did you start doing hospice work?
I was 30 years old. Yeah.
Okay.
I was young. I mean, I look back now and I'm like, oh, I was a baby. I would lead these grief support groups in a hospital in Chicago. And, you know, people would walk in and there would be women in their 60s who had just lost a husband or 40-something people who were grieving the loss of an older parent. And they would look at me and be like, oh, what does this girl know about anything? But I knew enough, you know, to kind of really facilitate a healing conversation. But I learned so much and I continue to learn every day from the people I see.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to a large extent, we have some commonalities from being young and holding space for elders. And really, that's what it really is. I mean, if we can just show up with love and compassion and hold the space for conversations that are raw and real and vulnerable and really need to have a space to be voiced, then that's really what our job is, no matter what age we're at. So
absolutely.
So I'm super curious because, you know, a lot of people that are listening to this, they have a difficult time really thinking that taking care of themselves is mission critical. They tend to more focus on the loved one that they have that is dealing with substance abuse disorder. But really, my calling has been, no, no, we need to take care of ourselves too.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious to know, like, where did that wisdom kind of come from for you at such an early age? And what was kind of the first, second, maybe third steps you took in the direction of you taking care of yourself?
Oh, well, I had to hit rock bottom before I realized that that was important. And I think, like you said, it's really, it's one of the last things we do is take care of ourselves. It's so much easier to take care of other people. Well, we think it is until we hit rock bottom or until like our own needs start to spill out everywhere. And so I myself really kind of hit some low points. And when I began to, there was nowhere else to go, but like, okay, I got it. I have to face this. I have to face my own needs, my grief, my anxiety, my anguish. And the first step for me was really self-compassion. And that was so hard. It was so hard to be kind to myself and to open up to self-compassion. I mean, I would just cry on yoga mats and like cry listening to self-compassion meditations. And I had spent years beating myself up or just being afraid to turn towards my grief because it was going to be too big and too unwieldy. I think that's one of the reasons we don't take care of ourselves is because it's scary. You know, there's so much there and it often feels insurmountable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know in the work that I do, I tell people, I say, look, I think you're thinking that if you start to cry, you won't stop.
Mm-hmm. I hear that a lot.
Yeah. And I'm here to tell you, you will.
Yeah.
You know, because I've had enough of those drop to my knees, lose it moments.
Me too.
And I think it sounds funny, but there's almost a skill set that goes with that. It's allowing yourself to drop into that kind of deep, deep, deep pool of emotion and giving yourself permission to do it. So being compassionate with yourself, that is just such a huge thing in the world that we swim in. What were you beating yourself up for? I'm just super curious.
Yeah. It's a funny thing I think we all do. I mean, we're really hard on ourselves in general, but we also hold ourselves accountable for things that we don't have control over.
Right.
This is like the great human experience. We're constantly holding ourselves accountable for things that we really don't have control over. And so I was holding myself accountable for not being there the night my mother died because I didn't make it to the hospital in time. Holding myself accountable for not being more aware that she was dying, for not having the wisdom to have conversations that needed to be had. And now in my 40s, I can look back and really understand how could I have, you know, our culture gets in the way of that. First of all, I was so young. She herself was prohibiting it, but I beat myself up for a long time around those things. Yeah. I was just so devastated that she was gone and our relationship had ended the way it did.
Yeah. And are you at peace with it today?
Yeah. And it took a lot of that self-compassion. It took a lot of understanding and sitting with other people who I saw, they were all going through the same thing. So many people were blaming themselves for things that they really couldn't have changed or done differently, or they had amazing intentions and really like put so much heart into something and it still didn't have the outcome that they wanted. And so seeing that, I realized that I was doing the same thing and that it's just not easy to be a human in this world.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in the addiction space, I think a lot of people hold the notion that we can control it, we can fix it. And wow, that just so gets in the way. And so to be able to kind of take that on, and at the same time, what I'm kind of imagining is the veils kind of got lifted and you realize that certainly you weren't alone in it. And there are lots of people, whether it's death and dying or whether it's just grieving all these things in our lives. I think we just kind of live in this world of something happens and it's letting it go, grieving and letting go, grieving and letting go. I think that's just a continual thing that's been my experience is as change takes place, it's okay, grieve what was and step into what is and learn how to swim and dance a new dance.
Absolutely. It's so hard to relinquish that illusion of control. We want so badly to think that we have more control than we do. It's scary to acknowledge that we don't, to really live in uncertainty, to live in the present moment, to not know what's going to happen. It's really hard.
Yeah. At least my experience has been it's changing what it is that I can control. It's shifting the notion that I can control other people or I can control circumstances or situation. But really, the control resides within ourselves in terms of what's the story we're making up about it. What emotions are we having? Are those the emotions that we want to have? Are those the thoughts we want to have? All of that. We're at agency in this and not left to be at the whim and whiff of what shows up.
Yeah, that was a turning point for me too. In my late 20s, I began to realize that I had always just felt like all this stuff was happening to me and that I just, you're right, there were pieces that I had control over. I had control over how I responded to things. You know, I had control over my emotional regulation or choosing what thoughts to listen to or choosing what behaviors to indulge in. So there were things that I did have control over, but they had felt so out of control because I was grappling with so much trauma.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and we're not trained in this.
Yeah, nobody told me how to do any of this.
Yeah. I mean, how often are we told, you know, you should read, you know, Man's Search for Meaning. You know, so the phrase in terms of when it feels like our life is falling apart, and I'm super big believer now decades of when it feels like it's falling apart, it's actually falling together. And that has been true for me, but it's also true for me because that's what I believe. So speak a little bit about kind of the poking at the beliefs that we carry around that don't serve us and then shifting those to beliefs that actually do serve us in living a more, I guess, thriving life.
Yeah. Around that same turning point where I began to feel more agency over moving forward in my life, I really started to realize how I had been looking at my whole life with this narrative of like what I didn't have, just like all these things I didn't have, all these things that had happened to me that were terrible. And I began to really force myself to shift that and to think, look at all that I do have. Look at all the amazing things I have going forward, the tools, the resources. Some of that for me came by finding ways to be of service. I had been very self-preoccupied in my grief. I just was really like sitting all the time and just feeling sorry for myself and really grieving. And at some point I started volunteering, working with kids in an underserved school district and just helping them with homework. And I was like, oh my God, I have so much to offer. Like I've been sitting around just feeling like so wrapped up in my pain and my misery. And I have so much that I can be contributing to the world. And that was really helpful for me as well in terms of just realizing what I had.
Well, that kind of a shift from self-preoccupation to service to others is, well, so transformative because our lives are what we focus on. And so if we're just focused on grief and pain and all of those things, then that's what our life is. And if we can like pop out of the bubble almost, or like, you know, poke at it a little bit and potentially get out and do something where it's other oriented, then we kind of begin to crack that, I think.
And it's, you know, it's like kind of a both and, right? Like I didn't have to stop grieving and stop missing my parents, but I was able to add in this other way of being in the world that felt really meaningful.
And so as you're saying that, what I'm thinking about is particularly for parents that have kids, whether they're adult or kids, dealing with substance abuse disorder, it's that notion that you can't have joy while they're experiencing their disorder. And I've had parents actually say to me, when I've asked, do you think that you could actually thrive in the midst of the chaos of, of this disease? And they're like, absolutely not. No way. Not going to happen. And they're not even going to give themselves permission to laugh or smile or be happy.
What do you think it means to them to hold that position? And what does it mean for them to try to hold both?
I can only surmise that there's several things going on. One is they don't believe that they can hold both in the same space. So it's an either or proposition in their minds. And so they're leaning into the grief of witnessing the suffering of their loved one, and then can't hold that suffering and that grief in the same space of being able to enjoy their own life or parts of their lives. And they're in their bubble.
Yeah.
They haven't reached out of their bubble to understand that, well, actually that is possible.
Yeah. I think there's a parallel that I see in grief where often people feel like they can't feel joy or enjoy things or laugh or cultivate aspects of their life while they're grieving. And again, it goes back to that both and. It doesn't mean you have to stop grieving. It doesn't mean you have to stop thinking about your child who's going through this struggle. You can do both. You can hold both spaces. And even if you just start to play around with it a little bit, you begin to see that you can do both. You can hold multitudes.
Right. Yeah. And I've talked about it in my own experience through the lens of, I kind of think about all these little bubbles of my life. You know, I have a marriage bubble and that's awesome. And I have career bubble and I love what I do. And I have friend bubbles and they're just amazing friends. And then I had this bubble with my son and that sucked. You know, when he was totally in the throes of his addiction and learning how to be with his suffering without being drug into his suffering, I didn't have to suffer with him.
Right. And I think there's like an abandonment fear too. Like you weren't abandoning him by being in your marriage bubbles and your friend circles and like your work and the, everything that you love. It's and grief is similar. It's like people think they're going to, they no longer are grieving or they don't care that their person died because they're over here enjoying, but you can do both.
Yeah. And I think that one notion, that one understanding for a lot of people is like, really?
Two things can be true at once.
Yes, exactly. So would you say a little bit about the notion of anxiety and grief and how anxiety is part of the grieving process? Because I think that is a different way to think about that.
For me, after my mother died, one of my predominant experiences was just panic attacks, hypochondria, this feeling of like feeling unsafe in the world. Because I think when we're grieving, we've lost something, right? Whether it's a way of life or a relationship or a person, we don't only grieve people who have died. We grieve all kinds of things, right? We grieve, I'm sure you grieved who your son was prior to his addiction or who he could have become or who he could have been in that moment. So you're grieving something that is gone. And when that happens, the landscape changes, right? Like the future becomes uncertain. You're not sure what is to come. You're not sure what other things could happen, or you have to let go of ideas you had of what life was going to be like. And that causes a lot of uncertainty, and uncertainty always brings anxiety. And so there's such a correlation there. And I think that not everybody becomes anxious in their grief, but a great many people do, and more than you think. And so the one thing I know for sure about it, there's a lot of ways to heal from it and manage it.
The statistics around anxiety at this point are just off the charts. And so the anxiety work, I think the way that I frame it is that we do not know how to deal with uncertainty or change. which in some respects seems very bizarre to me, because in a lot of ways, that's how I've just kind of lived my life, is I've been at the edge and jumped so many times. And so it's a muscle that I've perfected over time, but I didn't realize that was what I was doing. And so when things change, when you said grieving the loss of my son, I stood on a sidewalk and watched my son being arrested at gunpoint. And when I went back up to the hotel room, I dropped to my knees because everything had shattered in that moment.
Yeah.
But I also knew as the shattering was taking place, I knew that the pieces would be coming together in a very different way. So mm-hmm. I held that belief. And I think for a lot of people, the pieces shatter and then they have no idea like how to pick the pieces up or how to reconfigure them in a way that is going to serve them or lift them up to another level of consciousness or anything along those lines.
Yeah. And I think sometimes you don't need to know, be there. You just need to keep breathing, keep putting one foot in front of the other, and things begin to unfold. And I think it really helps to come back to that present moment when we're anxious and when we're grieving. Mm-hmm. We're spending a lot of time in the past. How did we get here? What happened? Yeah. Or ruminating on the way things could have been or were different. We're thinking a lot about the future. Mm-hmm. We're spending so little time in this present moment. Mm-hmm. So bringing your awareness back to this place can be really calming.
Yes. And so what are a couple kind of tricks, tips, hacks that you use to kind of, as you begin to kind of go in a direction of past or present, because I think that's just how our monkey minds work a lot of times. How do you bring yourself back to present and center?
Just like a lot of mindfulness and meditation techniques, I think are really helpful and easy. But there's that self-compassion piece too, because when mm-hmm. we're spinning out in the past and the future, we're worrying or we're trying to control an outcome or we're trying to review how we could have controlled an outcome. And so having self-compassion for like, okay, I understand why I'm spinning out about this, but I'm going to gently bring myself back to this present moment. And that's a big piece of it. And it can feel scary because again, it's about that illusion of control. If I don't worry about this thing, then, you know, so
yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a little crazy making.
It is definitely crazy making.
And so I'm going to ask you, I have this sense that the world that we live in is a worry world.
Absolutely. I think a lot of it is from technology in the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. I think that we have gotten so far away from being able to have quiet moments where we're not being bombarded by information. I mean, we are bombarded with information from the moment we wake up and pick up that little screen until we go to sleep and put the screen down. And it's just like so much is flooding in and we're not really thinking about how to regulate that, how to manage mm-hmm. it, how to step away for a moment. And just every time we look at our phones, we're taking in a news headline, what your best friend had for dinner last night, some like perfect holiday photo that makes you feel terrible about your life, you know, like all these things. And we're having emotional responses to them and we're having physical responses to them. We're having mm-hmm. behavioral responses to them. Mm-hmm. And so it's no wonder that the anxiety is through the roof.
Right. Well, and so I'm a geek kind of about the brain science stuff. And so everything has eclipsed our brain's ability to keep up. And we still are holding this notion that if we just work harder or faster, we'll be able to. And no.
Yeah, no.
We actually can't. And so regulating our phones, regulating how much we're willing to put up with toxic people in our lives, regulating what we listen to, what we read, who we surround ourselves with, all of these kinds of things, the way that I think about it is that's taking our power back.
Yeah, absolutely. During the pandemic, when it was like one of its real states of heightened anxiety, where we really weren't sure what was happening. And mm-hmm. I was getting so panicky and stressed out every morning that I decided I wasn't going to look at my phone for an hour after I woke up. And so I would wake up and I would just be in the world and I would make coffee and I would look out the window and I would talk to my kids. Mm-hmm. And then once I felt more centered and just kind of calm, then I would inevitably pick up the phone, look at some crazy headline or respond to text messages, but I was able to better process them and come from a place of more groundedness.
Yeah. I think that quiet time in the morning is Well, I think of it as mission critical. Is I'm a backpacker, and so being able to get into the backcountry and be completely disconnected, I've been doing it for decades now. And so, but you can't always backpack. But it taught me the importance of the disconnection and giving myself permission to disconnect.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think sometimes that can feel scary, but it really is one of the ways that we can come back to ourselves and feel that groundedness.
And is there kind of a typical thing that you're seeing on a regular basis that people present as kind of the thing that they're dealing with?
In terms of grief and anxiety or? I think we struggle a lot to find space to grieve and to make space to grieve. Our culture really doesn't hold a lot of space for it. Our culture wants us to keep moving, get on with things, be better. It's scary for people to see other people grieving or going through loss. So they want to tidy it up as well. And so I think that we push ourselves to move through it faster than we can. And that's one issue. And then the anxiety often comes from that place too. What's wrong with me? Why am I not myself anymore? What happened to my old self? We grieve versions of our own identities that we lose the way in the process. But making space for it and just leaning into it, acknowledging that this is a process that we all go through and need to sit with is really important.
I think there's a continual thread through this conversation in terms of creating space and quietness and just allowing ourselves to be.
Yeah. And to honor the present moment and the process that we're in, even if it's falling apart, even if it's crying, even if it's on your knees on the floor, just honoring that, not trying to rush through it necessarily.
Right. I think I'm in a business coach and consultant and all of those things. And so, but I very heavily lean on a person walks through my door first, or an executive team, there are people walking in the door first before they're executives. And so I see a lot of trauma and drama in their lives, whether it's suicide or death or divorce or addiction or all of the things. And I'm constantly in the space of saying, number one, you need to give yourself grace.
Yeah, absolutely. We're so hard on ourselves. And like we were talking about at the beginning of the conversation, it's so much easier to take care of other people, to have empathy for others, to kind of give them some grace than we do for ourselves.
Yeah. So if you're listening, please, self-compassion and grace.
What do you think the process of grieving a loved one who's struggling with addiction is like? Like, what is that grief like?
Wow. You know, what I think about is deep sorrow. And I'm speaking from my experience and the people that I have talked to and worked with. But the corresponding piece of that, it's born out of deep love. And so I think people coming to grips with the fact that the grief is a reflection of how deeply you love this person. And I think how difficult it is for most people to watch people suffering. And addiction in particular is this crazy combination of a lot of suffering. And then you weave in that it changes your brain chemistry and, you know, who you knew that person to be prior to addiction and who they are now when in addictive mode versus in recovery mode. It's almost head spinning.
I imagine there's similar components to grieving the death of someone where there's anger, there's guilt, there's blame, there's anguish, all of these pieces that we move through in different ways, loss of faith, loss of so many different identities.
Definitely. And my hope is that people are doing it in the journey of, instead of waiting for that moment where somebody dies and then it all kind of blows up. My hope is, at least the people that I get to work with and in my own journey, is there's a fireman's piece that I work with, and it starts with crisis, struggling, surviving, and then thriving. And I was very clear when I had my drop to my knees moment with my son, was that I was intentional about, yes, I'm in crisis right now. And I know what I need to do on the other side of falling out. And so I started to put those things in place. But my intention was not to survive this. My intention was actually to thrive in the midst of the chaos. Yeah. And just that notion in of itself, for a lot of people's like, what?
Yeah. I think it can be hard to imagine in the beginning that you will not only survive, but eventually thrive, and that it could be a really, truly transformative experience. I work with a lot of people who've just gone through a very big recent loss, and it's not something that they necessarily are ready to embrace the idea of.
Right.
At some point will be transformational in positive ways, but it is there, and it's something that takes time and looks different for everyone and encompasses lots of different components and pathways too. But there is so much transformation that comes through these drop to your knees moments where it feels like everything has fallen apart and you've lost everything. It does come back together in a new way.
Well, I'm a big believer in there are always gifts and lessons embedded in every experience. And so I think the questions that we ask ourselves on a routine basis, we're designed to look for the answers. Mm-hmm. And so I know in some of the really traumatic conversations I've had with some parents, if I can get permission for them to entertain the notion of gifts and lessons embedded in the experience, and we can start down that path, everything shifts. And usually it's the first time where they've even entertained the notion that there are gifts and lessons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think we can look back, like I'm always wanting to shield my kids from hardship. You know, I have young kids and then I'll make myself stop. And I think every hard thing I've ever been through has taught me something, you know, really valuable. And so it's hard and it hurts, but there's a lot there to be found.
Yeah. Well, the whole notion of helping our kids learn resiliency and, you know, on the other side of this, I mean, I'm in my mid-60s at this point, and my son is 32. But if I had known what I know now, you know, in terms of the resiliency muscle, but also the ability to ask for help.
Yeah.
When you need it. We're all going to have so many moments where we need to reach out to somebody, or a book, or a movie, or a podcast, or something where we start to ask for help.
Yeah. And I think that's such a critical aspect of this. We have to ask for help. We have to get support. We can't do this alone. Yeah.
And no, this is definitely a team sport.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So do you kind of frame your own experience and your own journey now in having been some of the gifts that led to this calling? And I ask that because I believe what you do in the world has a reverberation out that is just so, it's like the butterfly, you know, that in the hurricane. It's like what you do has such a reverberation out in terms of positivity and optimism and possibility in the world that started with grief.
That's a really beautiful way to look at it. I don't think I've thought about it that succinctly. I do really love what I do, and I see so much healing occur and so much transformation occur in the people I work with. And it's so beautiful to see. And I do have moments sometimes where I'm like, it is amazing that it was all born out of so much pain that I went through and my parents went through.
Yeah. Right. Right. Have you come to that place where the way that I think about it is loving people through their unfolding and their journey, and I don't begin to know what the purpose of their life is. And so it has given me peace, I think, in my son's addiction, is to know, I don't know what his purpose is, but what I do know is the Voices in Courage would not exist if it hadn't been for his addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a much larger consciousness evolution at play, the way that I think about it.
Yeah, I think you're touching into something that I think is important in grief too, where it's like you have to open up to all these new ways of thinking about the world and the universe, what we're doing here and who we are. And it's not that you have to land on anything or prove anything or figure out what happens when we die or figure out why some people have some paths or what their purpose is. But it's just opening up to the idea that there is so much going on that we don't maybe fully understand, but that we can lean into and that we can have some kind of faith in and belief in. And I think that that is a really important part of going through any kind of grief and loss or, you know, life struggle, is opening up to the idea that it's, we're not just this one person, that it's like all here. It's like we're connected to so much and there's so many ripple effects happening all the time, and we don't know what they're going to lend themselves to.
Yeah. So I think about at your age, you're able to look back and connect dots. Some people haven't lived enough or haven't had the perspective of actually looking back to connect how these dots in our lives happen. But I did a vision quest process a few years ago. And one of the things I was tasked with was to look back over every decade of my life and write down the things that I viewed as incredibly powerful and positive, and the things that I viewed as dark and they sucked. And so I did all of that. And then as I looked back over them, I saw the dark, crappy things. Oh my God, the flip side. Oh, look at the extraordinary that came out of that in creating who I am today. And then to be able to see the dot connections was transformative, honestly.
That's a really, really cool exercise. Everybody mm-hmm. should do that. We should all be mm-hmm. doing that all the time. I'm going to do it.
Okay, great. I will say it was completely transformative. So the other thing I'm thinking about feels a little bit like I'm bouncing, but that's the ADHD, is who did you turn to book-wise, listening to, that helped you kind of transform your journey? Like, there were times when I pulled Byron Katie off the shelf. There were times when I pulled Eckhart Tolle off the shelf. And I accessed things when things were tough. I was like, okay, up my skills, reach for this. Okay, up my skills, reach for that. Who did you reach for?
Initially, I was so young. So I was 18, 20. This was like late 90s. And I just started reading memoirs. I wanted to read any story by someone who went through something difficult. And came through the other side somehow.
Yeah.
And that was really helpful to me. It was helpful to me to see that other people struggled, that other people felt shame and blame and guilt and made mm-hmm. mistakes and yet still kept trying. So that initially was what really helped me. And then I love Pema Chodron. Mm-hmm. I love Byron Katie as well. Mm-hmm. I did a lot of meditation. So just all kinds of people in that space. I love poetry too.
Oh.
I really like Mary Oliver, just some mm-hmm. where you can find just language for some of this, language for right. anguish and pain and sorrow and beauty.
Yeah. I think just having access to other people's ways of looking and languaging the world. I know even today, I mean, I'm a huge reader and podcast listener too, and all of the things. I'll hear a phrase and I'll go, oh man, okay, I want to capture that one. And you can feel it almost like come into you. And like, there's just this little shift that takes place.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we have to keep seeking out those things. And they're not always there. You won't always find the right fit, but you keep mm-hmm. looking, keep reading mm-hmm. through things, keep listening. There's going to be something that really gives you one of those aha moments.
Yeah, for sure. And so what I want our listeners to listen to here is keep reaching out, keep searching, and get outside of yourself and look for the people that you can resonate with, where you can feel safe with, ask for what you need. And I think that's another one too, that we haven't necessarily touched a lot on, but we've alluded to that's what we've been doing in our journeys, is we've in some form or fashion been asking for what we needed in order to navigate wherever we were.
Yeah. I think it's really scary to ask for what you need, right? Like we become afraid of rejection or abandonment, but mm-hmm. I think we have to keep asking and keep searching and not keep our worlds too small.
And I tend to frame everything in a skill set that can be developed, because it feels like, well, anybody can do that mm-hmm. to me. So the skill set of like just test driving, asking for what you need mm-hmm. from somebody who's safe, that yeah, you feel yeah. pretty certain you're going to get a, oh, sure, I can do that. And keep doing that to build that particular skill up, so that when you really do need to ask for something that you need, you've already got it kind of in your pocket, so to speak.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. Baby steps.
Yeah, baby steps. We all have to start somewhere. So do you have a favorite book that you've written?
Written five. My first book felt really meaningful. It's my actual story. It's a memoir of mm-hmm. my experience. So that one's very special. I wrote a book that is called Anxiety, The Missing Stage of Grief, and is meaningful because it's one of the first times that anxiety and grief have been called out in correlation. And so it's been an important book. And then I have a new book coming out in March called Conscious Grieving. And it's really about leaning into our grief as a way to move through it. And so I wrote one about the afterlife that was really fun to kind of explore as well. Yeah, they've all been different. They're like kids, you know, each one has a different personality. You love them all.
Well, I think the origin stories are always amazing to know kind of from whence we came. But I love the consciousness grieving.
Conscious grieving, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just now kind of getting into the map of consciousness and David Hawkins' work and so on and so forth. But I love how it's married up with chakras and all of the things. Yeah. And then the reverberation out in terms of how we show up in the world and the level of impact that we can have in helping shift humanity.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so you've done huge work.
Thank you. It sounds like you have too. You're doing so much amazing work, creating this space for people to heal and to really think about and understand their process.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't available when I dropped to my knees that day. And I was like, are you serious? I have to put this together. And so I was like, okay, well, then that's what it is. So start doing it.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I'm grateful that you're doing it.
Thank you. Thank you. So as we're wrapping up here, is there something we haven't touched on or a question I should have asked you that would serve our audience in the midst of their journey?
I just want to reiterate this, you know, idea of giving yourself permission to grieve. I think for a long time, we relegated grief to death, and it's not. It's we grieve for so many things, and grief in this realm around addiction and people we love is so valid and so real. And it's something that really, it's a process that shouldn't be rushed through. It's a process that needs support, that needs self-compassion, that needs tending to. So really creating that space for yourself and giving yourself permission to grieve is important.
Yeah. And I do think understanding that it's just part of the human process. Mm-hmm. It's part of being human.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, the way that I think about it is that deep love goes with deep grief.
Yeah,
and absolutely. I'd rather deeply love.
Yeah, me too.
So thank you so much. This has been a great weaving of a conversation. Yeah. And again, I want to just say thank you, thank you, thank you. Deep gratitude for the work that you're doing in the world and the lives that you're changing and the perspective and all the things in the books. And thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for the work you're doing.
Absolutely. How can people get a hold of you?
ClaireBidwellSmith.com.
Great.
Everything's there.
Everything's there. So reach out to her. That hub is fantastic. And she is a great resource for those of us who are going through the process of being human. So
thank you.
Again, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for joining us on this episode. If you're looking for help to go from surviving to thriving in the midst of chaos with the right tools and resources, subscribe at voicesencourage.com. We encourage you to share with friends and family going through similar situations so we can continue to build a strong community of hope and possibility. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.